Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
My next guest has been documenting the drama and drudgery of Irish politics for 12 years. It's only been 12. It feels like he's been around much longer than that. He basically knows everything about the inner workings of Dáil Éireann and the Shannon. His new book is The Secret Life of Leinster House. He is the political correspondent with Virgin Media. Gavin Riley, good morning.
Morning, Oliver. How are you?
I was trying to find out, were you ever in the RTE Radio Centre?
The last time I was inside the building, I think, was for a debate among the presidential candidates back in 2018, which
really?
Is frighteningly almost 7 years ago.
You can cover that as an outside.
Yes, so you're allowed to come in. They let the private sector come in to supervise what's going on for those days. But I have actually, I've been in this room before, as I was saying to you just when I was coming in off air, for one of Marty Morrissey's bank holiday shows. My sister-in-law was singing something and she sang literally in this studio, and I stood right over there underneath that monitor right there with a 20-year-old banged-up keyboard playing accompaniment for The Last Rose of Summer.
So you have that talent as well?
Yeah, lifelong pianist. That was my parents' first passion. Before they were like, oh, go talk for a living. They were like, go learn play
you
piano.
Have many passions, and yet for all the how much of yourself you put on social media and so on, we don't know a huge amount about you. You're a Meath man, aren't you? Very
yes,
proud.
Yeah. Meath man and a Man United fan, and regrettably I used up all my magnanimity the week before last for Louth, so I can't bring myself to congratulate the Spurs fans today.
Wikipedia doesn't know how old you are.
38.
Are you 38? Yes. Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Somebody will update that.
Yes.
I would have thought you'd been the person who would have done that. Anyway.
Well, it feels like it's been longer than 12 years. It feels like you've aged me slightly more than that.
But you do feel like you've been on telly for much longer than that. Come here. I want to start on a personal level, since we're talking about you, because autism services are top of the political agenda that you report on.
Yeah.
And this also affects you and your young family. Tell us, if you don't mind, about your daughter, Dirren.
Yeah, Dirren is, she'll be six in July.
Really?
Yes, which is, when you put it that way, first of all, you're like, God, where did that happen? Because it sort of feels like she turned two, and then you have one of those Pathé newsreel, like, scene missing cards, and then suddenly she was four or five, and I don't know where those years went. Yeah. She is six in July. We began to notice between 12 and 18 months that she was missing some of her developmental milestones. And shortly after she turned two, we simultaneously went to go looking for a private diagnosis of autism, and we were invited to a 2-year checkup with our local public health nurse. And they agreed that there was a few developmental milestones that were missing, and they referred her onto the books of what people might have heard in the news this week, the CDNT, Community Disability Network Team.
Yes.
So she was almost officially on their books from a month after she turned two. And that's where the whole assessment of need process that people will have heard about on the news is supposed to kick in. Because by law, you're entitled to begin your assessment of need within 3 months of your referral. You're supposed to be, by law, have that completed within another 3 months. And the month after that, then you're supposed to have what's called a service statement, which outlines the therapies that we think your child might benefit from and our plan for how to deliver them. She is six, as I said, in July, so she's nearly 4 years undergoing that process. She got the assessment of needs November before last, after about 28 months, I think, or so.
Oh,
and
God.
She's still waiting for the service statement. She hasn't got it.
Really?
And we're very lucky in that we're a double income, comfortable household. So we were able to pursue the private route. We got her private diagnosis. We still pay for private therapies, and we're able to do what we can for her. But we recognise that we're largely the exception because we have the capability of being able to find a psychologist who could do the diagnosis and be able to pursue therapies afterwards.
Not without a lot of fighting, particularly by your wife.
Yeah, no, my wife has become a real, like, it's a cause that she's taken very much to her heart, not alone because she's a parent, but also because she's a teacher by training. She's a college lecturer in teacher education. So the educational management of kids with additional needs is now something which has become very close to her heart as well. But she's also very conscious that a lot of what we've learned about how you try to deal with the system and the way that you navigate a lot of the complexity that's there is not stuff that you ever learn from the state. You know, like, nobody ever sends you a manual and says, right, this is what a CDNT is. This is what an assessment of need is. This is what a service statement is. It's all stuff that you learn in WhatsApp groups from other parents. And whatever we've been able to harness from other parents, we try to do our best to pass it forward. And my wife is brilliant at doing that. She's become a real crusader on it. But like, it's such a myriad.
Dirren's in school and she goes off on a minibus.
She goes, the school that she's in is about 20 minutes drive away as the crow flies. So if you were going door to door, it would be 20 minutes. But because the school, she's in a school which we've not in the catchment area of. So they send a minibus around to pick herself up and a lot of the other kids that don't live within the vicinity of the school, and it snakes around, and it's about an hour or an hour and 10 minutes every day on the way out. Wow. And an hour and 10 minutes on the way back. And like, she's not even six yet. She's pre-verbal.
And you have to put your little daughter on the bus on her.
Yeah. And like during winter times when, and it's her second year on that bus. So like, she was getting on it when she was four with people who were at the time relative strangers. Like, they've almost become like family now because we know them so much. But like, it's
pre-verbal means, yeah, she's not able to tell you at the end of, yes, the day how the day has gone.
So you, like, we're lucky that we get a voice note in the Aladdin app that a lot of parents might know. We get a voice note from her teacher when she's finished the school day to let us know how it went on, which is great. And her teacher Emma is an absolute darling, and we're thrilled that she has her. But it's kind of, by and large, it's the exception, and one of the many inconsistencies or inconveniences or inefficiencies about the whole system is that we can be almost certain that when she's on her minibus driving around for about an hour, snaking around to get to her school, there's probably a lot of other kids that are on minibuses snaking in the opposite direction, because there is no central switchboard that makes sure that the school which is closest to you, which is best equipped to cater to your child's needs, is actually the one that you're in. It's all a bit of a harem scarem. Oh, I know someone who's just graduated from there that's leaving that class, so I know a place is going to come up in that class, and who do you know, and can you get in touch with them, and are you lucky enough to get in before the enrolment closes?
With your family involved, and as a journalist covering this at a granular level, is this something that politics can fix?
You have to hope that it does, because like, I mean, one of the reasons why I find my job in general so compelling is that ultimately everything comes through politics. Like, if you care about marriage equality, like we're discussing today, for after 10 years of the referendum, that has to come through Leinster House to get fixed. Environmentalism or foreign affairs, or they all have to come through Leinster House. So you have to hope that politics or politicians can fix it.
A lot of hoping and a lot of campaigning.
I wish I knew how. Like I said, there's a lot of inefficiencies in the system. The one thing at least which is easier, given the marriage of my professional and personal lives, you have to, by your nature, you have to try and be passive or disassociate yourself from the material at hand. And generally, I'm quite passive in life, so I'm comfortable saying, well, on one hand X, but on the other hand Y. And I'm comfortable putting two sides of an argument to viewers.
You're very measured in your mind.
It's a little easier, at least in this subject, because there's nobody saying that the status quo is okay. Like, I don't have to go on the news and include 15 or 20 seconds of a clip from someone who says, actually, the disability services are A-okay and they're completely up to scratch and everything is fine. Nobody is saying that, which at least makes it easier then to cover professionally.
True.
Because at least no one is trying to defend it as it is.
A terrible system. Let's get to the book. It's very comprehensive, speaking about how politics can fix things. I don't think people, it's common knowledge about the hotlines and how important it is that TDs get their hands on the hotlines. It sounds like a kind of a 90s reference. You picture a rotary dial red telephone or something.
Or people ringing up Tony Fenton and asking for it.
Exactly. Direct lines to civil servants who have pull. What are these? How important are they?
So when you think about when you might call up a TD because, let's say, for example, you've realised you're going on holiday in 2 weeks and your passport has just expired or is about to expire, and suddenly it's panic. Oh God, what am I going to do? I can apply for it, but I don't know if I'll get turned around. I'll ring the local TD and see what they can do. If you think about, well, what is it that you expect the TD to do? Like, do you think the TD has any more rights to call up someone than you might do and say, listen, could you get Oliver's passport sorted out now because he's going to Tarmelinas in 2 weeks? But what TDs have are basically special backdoor hotlines that are almost built by design into these services. So if you are the passport service, there will be an Oireachtas members hotline that you can call or email so that you can say, my constituent Gavin is going on holidays in 2 weeks and he needs his passport. Can you try and make sure that it's expedited? Or my constituent Oliver has rung up because an elderly relative of his needs a hip replacement and she can't afford to wait too long. Would you mind having a look at it? So there are all these backdoors into the system.
Hip replacements. It's in the health service. Is it everywhere?
Everywhere.
Are there other services?
The best equipped new TDs are ones who either inherit a kind of a handbook of all of these hotlines,
right,
or the ones who have the wherewithal early on to find out about these hotlines and to consolidate all the numbers.
Do you know they exist?
Well, I know, for example, the Green Party were very good at making sure that their new TDs last time were given a handbook that had all these things. So if you're a brand new TD and someone says, sorry, my mother needs a hip operation, can you call someone? Or my passport is going to be late, can you call someone?
And they seem to be direct services for citizens, don't they, rather than I need this road done today.
And a lot of politicians are openly critical about, or like almost lamenting the fact that these things exist, but they almost exist by necessity, because if the same hotline was open to absolutely everyone, then everyone would use it and it would be swamped by the inefficiency and you wouldn't be able to get the expedited service that you want.
What a way to think about
it. But we elect people who are ostensibly supposed to be national policymakers and national lawmakers, but they end up spending a lot of their time calling up hotlines that they have access to that no one else does,
and
so they can sort out
them
the HIP.
For providing the services we're already entitled to, but we can't get to
and some
without the hotlines.
And some TDs are unabashed about making entire careers out of how good they are at knowing the hotlines and who to call and how to fix stuff.
Voters love them for it.
And they don't necessarily get elected because of their worldviews. They get elected because, oh, he's the fella who fixed the road. And because he's good at doing it, and it is almost always a he.
Is it written down? Are the records about how many lines records kept on how many lines there are? Who contacts them? What gets fixed for whom?
I don't know if there's a documented list of how often they get used, but definitely if you were to go trawling through the written Dáil questions, often you'll find independent TDs a couple of years into their term suddenly realising that these hotlines exist and putting in a written Dáil question to the minister saying, "Can the Minister for Foreign Affairs please tell me the number for the hotline for the passports?" And you'll see them there. So there's ways of trawling to get them all, but you can't call them up as a member of the public because they'll go, who do you say is ringing? Gavin Riley, you're not a TD, are you? And they'll hang up the phone on you. So it's
would they actually?
They likely would, or they'd say, sorry, you might be aware, sir, this is a service for Oireachtas members only, and fob you off.
So that's the hotlines. The description of voting time as well in the Dáil is great crack. It's like a sketch version of kind of early Mission Impossible films, isn't it, where they have... I don't think a lot of people know about this 8-minute dash to the chamber they have to get to vote.
Yeah, because there's a rule that the doors to the chamber are sealed, so that they can't have this indeterminate time where they start ringing the bells around the whole campus, and a lot of people's offices, there are now so many TDs and so many staff, their offices aren't always in the Leinster House building. They're in adjoining multi-stories, or they might be in Agriculture House just down the road.
Yeah.
So they need a certain amount of time to get into the chamber. But at a certain point, you also have to cut it off and say, listen, lads, we have to lock the doors and get the votes going now.
So they
give them 8 minutes. So if you're a TD, often an independent TD, and your office is above in Agriculture House down the street.
There are no offices in Leinster House for TDs.
Not anymore, no. There are adjoining multi-stories, but Leinster House, the Georgian building itself that you see on the news, doesn't have accommodation for TDs.
So down the road, Bell goes off 8 minutes.
Scarper! Ah! Yeah, panic. And you have to get down and try and get into the chamber after 8 minutes. So the bells go for 4 minutes to summon you, and then they go silent for another 4 minutes while you make your way. And after 8 minutes, they have to lock the doors. And there was an example when the government was being appointed in January of, I think, one of the new Fine Gael TDs who was outside the door. They got caught talking to some well-wishing constituent or somebody on the corridor, and it was their first time as a TD, and they didn't realise that actually, no, the doors are about to seal behind you. So then they get to the door and they're like, hello, Mr. Usher, I'd like to come in to vote for the Taoiseach now, please. And they go, sorry, 8 minutes, the doors are sealed.
A rude awakening.
There used to be a workaround where the doors to the press gallery, where we all sit and overlook the business, weren't locked. And there's a famous example, I can't remember who they were, but back I think in the late 70s or early 80s, two latecomers showed up a couple of seconds too late, but realised they could still come down the corridor to the press gallery, hop over our little countertop, and then hop onto the uppermost of the back benches.
Dangerous.
And climb in that way. With the end result being that we're also now locked in for those 8 minutes.
So you're now locked in, for the 8 minutes. And there are tunnels, some of them don't find out about until after. Well, you're a new TD.
This is part of the general theme of what I'm trying to get at in the book, is that you expect that they all arrive fully formed and fully fledged, and that they all know their way around, but that it is a very high profile, high stress working environment in which there basically is no operating manual. Like there's a high profile female TD who I won't name, but I met her in one of the underground tunnels a couple of years ago, and it was the first time she'd realised there was a tunnel between the building that has the committee rooms and the building that has the Dáil chamber itself.
God.
She was always walking outside because she thought it was the only way to get from A to B.
Running around in the rain.
And she was like, I can't believe that I've gone into the Dáil chamber with my hair blown all over the shop, with like the humidity ruining my lovely.
And it took her 3 years
to find out that there was a tunnel because no one shows
no
you
one
these
told
things.
Her. Yeah. Let's get to the gravy train of politics. People love talking about this, but you have a surprising amount of sympathy for TDs here, and you think it's overstated, the salary and expenses they get.
Having spoken to them, it is not as cosseted as you might think. And I'm going to say from the outset that like there's no getting away from the fact that a headline salary of 116,000 odd for a TD is a very good wage. Mm-hmm. And they are all very mindful, very publicly, that the pension is the great bit. And if you're lucky enough to get
wonderful pension,
to get more than a couple of years, because you have to serve 20 years to get the full pension. And if you're a first time
TD, to serve 20 years now to get as a TD
to get the full pension. So in the public
if
service,
you're a minister, is it 2 years now? Is it up
2 years for the minimum, and then it sort of caps off if you've done, I think, 10 years in cabinet, which only a few people get to do. But you have to serve 20 years to get the full parliamentary pension. And if you're lucky enough to get elected once or twice and you get 10 or 15 or 20 years, the pension is very good. But the headline salary doesn't quite tell the full story, because first of all, 19.9% of the headline salary is immediately taken away to pay for the pension.
Yeah.
So the headline salary of 116,000-ish becomes about 93,000-ish. Mm. Again, still a very good salary, but it's not
but they're contributing to this pension, yeah.
And then they get two allowances on top of that, the infamous expenses, which are actually allowances. They get the parliamentary representation allowance, which covers the cost of running your constituency office, and then they get the travel and accommodation allowance, which is you're commuting up and down to Leinster House, your hotel's in Dublin, and you're commuting around the constituency. Mm. Which is sometimes an overlooked bit, because if you're a TD for Kerry, there's a lot of driving around the back roads of Kerry to represent everyone, and it's to cover that. But those latter two haven't been increased for quite a while, and the cost of living has gone up quite a bit. And for example, the parliamentary representation allowance, which is designed to cover the cost of a constituency office, is only designed to cover the cost of one office at rates which might have been commensurate to about 10 years ago. So if you're a TD for, say, Kerry, you might be expected to have a constituency office in Killarney, but also in Tralee, because you couldn't possibly leave them unattended. But the allowance only pays for one of those offices.
It's 20 grand or something, isn't it? So it's not going to stretch your
And it's supposed to cover the overheads and the utility
bills. It's an allowance,
so
they don't have to prove they've spent the 30,000 to 35,000 for TDs outside of Dublin.
Although that is actually audited at the end of the year for some of them as well.
It
they
is,
have to prove
it?
That they have
so
to give it back.
If I'm a TD and I need to stay in Dublin tonight, it's €700 a night now for hotels because of a match or a concert. They can't just send that on to the taxpayer.
No, they get the allowance paid to them up front at the start of the month. And if it covers the hotel, great. And if not, they either make a very long drive home in the dead of night, as some of them have admitted to doing, or they pay the balance out of their own pockets.
Right.
I think post-tax, the salary comes to about 4,500. And I don't want to come across like a bleeding
per
heart
month.
For TDs per month.
Yeah.
Like it's obviously, it's a very good wage. But when you consider that you might have to pay the costs of a second office, and the allowance that you get doesn't cover the astronomical price of a Dublin hotel anymore, it doesn't actually leave you with as much after tax as you think it would. So they're very well looked after when they turn 65 and they're entitled to the pension, but it's not actually a job where, until you become a minister, it's not a job where they say you feel the benefit of the wage you're getting. Mm.
There are some obviously massive things like the severance payments for long-standing TDs. Mm-hmm. I think Enda Kenny's was about 140,000 when he left, and he'd also got a severance payment of leaving.
Yeah, because you get your ministerial severance, which he got in 97, even though he was still a TD at the time. So now you get a severance payment or a lump sum for the parliamentary pension, and you might get a lump sum or severance for the ministerial part. So if you are someone who stands down after, like Eamon Ryan, you stand down after a few years in cabinet and after a long parliamentary career, the lump sum is very good, and it's great at the end of your working life. But like I say, that if you're along the way, if you're still trying to live off it in the meantime, it's not as comfortable as the headline salary.
There are lots of private opportunities, obviously, opportunities in the private sector. If you have a high profile career as a TD or a minister,
and you can become an advisor in public affairs or a lobbyist, and of course, the one advantage of being a former member of the Oireachtas is that you have lifelong access to the building and to the members' bar, for example,
and so, free parking for life.
And so, if you need to be able
to
go in and talk to people who might now have sway over a thing that you're invested in, you still have the right to walk into the building the way that other citizens don't.
But you cover the misery of TDs, secret misery, really, really, really well, and marriage breakups, which is quite sad, although you don't press people specifically on that.
Yeah. No, so you can't be certain that their professional investment was the reason why their personal life went the way it did. But there's a good overlap there.
I love the civil servants bit, where it's almost quietly said, you speak, it's an extraordinary quote from a top civil servant who's now retired, a former Secretary General of the Department, and they see themselves as CEOs, don't they? And the ministers as a mere chair.
Mm.
So they see themselves as the bosses.
Yeah, which in a way, from a HR perspective, they are. And so much of their job is tied up with just making sure that the show is kept on the road and that appropriate staffing is made for these things and that a vacancy isn't allowed to sit for too long. So they have to spend so much of their time thinking about the staffing of the department that they don't often have the same bandwidth that politicians would like for the reform of department. And civil servants, sometimes they get a bad rep, and there's occasions where it's warranted, but they get a bad rep because they're seen as being so change averse and risk averse. And a minister who wants to come in and totally reinvent a system will often find themselves just being ground down by the civil servants. He'll say, well, that there's no proof that that would work, Minister. And we've always done it this way and we think this way is fine. Yeah. It's not brilliant, but it's fine. It works. Why would you change it?
And they will never see themselves as the staff of the minister. They work for the department
only. Yes, yeah.
And this statement of strategy, which again, I don't think is common
knowledge. Yeah, it's a very, very nerdy, wonky thing. And even some of the ministers I spoke to didn't appear to fully grasp how significant it is. But a few months after a new minister takes over, they're supposed to, the department issues at a corporate level by the Secretary General, a statement of strategy. And that's actually an opportunity if the minister has their wits about them to make sure that the department's strategy and their political strategy in the programme for government are on the same page, that the machinery of the state is now built to achieve the stuff that they want to. But the civil servants don't answer to the minister. They answer to their Secretary General, and the Secretary General has their own workload to deal with. So sometimes new ministers might be so overwhelmed or swamped trying to learn the ropes that they miss the opportunity to make the system bend to their will.
A clever civil servant has it written for them. They go, don't worry about that, ministers.
It's only a statement of strategy. You'd be worried about making your big speech there, introducing that bill now. But the staff are answerable to the SecGen, and the SecGen issues the statement of strategy, and if the minister doesn't get their imprint on it, then the ship might have sailed before they realised.
There are wonderful anecdotes throughout this and other things I don't think the public are fully aware of, but if you want to make it in this business, this is the book to get. The Secret Life of Leinster House. Gavin O'Reilly, thanks a million.
Pleasure, Oliver. Thank you for having me.
I want to tell you, you're also in conversation with your colleague Zara King next Tuesday at the Imperial Hotel in Cork. Tickets are available on easons.com. Tickets. No less. But published by Gill Books, The Secret Life of Leinster House is out now. Thanks a million for coming back to the Radio Centre. We didn't even make you play piano.
Maybe next time.
Good luck. See you.
Thanks, Oliver.